writing an article on jazz producers, and I wanted to talk to you about two things, basically. One is your philosophy of production, and I mean, one of the things that strikes me about your work is that there are plenty of producers who just put out collections of songs, but you put out, you know, real records that have cohesiveness. So I'm interested in how you came to that, to make that type of a coherent kind of project. And then secondly, I'd like to ask you about a few specific sessions.
Okay.
Let's just start with a first and more philosophical question.
Right.
I mean, it seems that at one point there were people who, like at Columbia, some staff producers, Teo Macero, George Ivakian, and they produced jazz albums, and
right.
then that stopped for some reason.
Right.
How do you account for the fact that it stopped, and then how do you account for why you make jazz albums?
Well, I think, and unfortunately, we're dealing with less and less of a lower standard or a lower quality of people. And a lot of people just don't really invest as much into it now. Now seems to be a time where people are more interested in money and fame and credibility. And I think from the time you're speaking of, people actually were really motivated, and they were artists, and they were trying to create something. They were catalysts and decision makers, and using their judgment and intuition to decide, to determine, and to produce something. And it's not too many examples of that now. Everyone's really on the take, as
mm-hmm.
far as I can see. And there's not a lot of really talented artists in that position. We're dealing with a kind of a lower quality.
And what do you think led you to say, I'm going to make a different kind of record?
Well, I first was a musician, and I sort of learned the hard way about being on the other end of that. And I came into making records and being responsible and coordinating things out of the necessity to have a bit more control over what I thought was valuable, or my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I just acquired control more and more out of the need to be responsible for what I was doing. And you just learn step by step all the ways to make something happen, whether it's to force something, whether it's to mutate it or manipulate it or destroy it, or whether it's to let it grow organically. It's all down to a kind of spontaneous or basic intuition about performance and sound. And there's a magic there that people won't be able to appropriate unless they've had a certain kind of experience.
Yeah. Now, were there recordings when you were younger that you said, this is a model for the kind of thing I'd like to do?
Well, there have always been those references for people as they grow up. I'm sure there are things that you hear that strike you as production and not just, you know, someone setting up some mics and getting on with it. In a lot of cases, there were things that definitely struck me as being productions, but very rarely in the genre or the jazz sort of idiom.
Right.
There should be more of that. There could have been. I think things that were done in and around Miles Davis's work, and that would, I guess, be Teo Macero, where there was a lot of extreme editing and effects and things that go from an early time. I think those were definitely influences on myself and probably other people. But it wasn't production on the level of, let's say, at the same time, what was being done to recordings made by, let's say, Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
Or even other rock groups. I'm not necessarily a fan of the Beatles, but there were certain production, very abstract production approaches and things done to certain records, which would have been probably the work of George Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that these people were definitely having a voice or having an imprint on what the result was. It wasn't traditional, it wasn't purist, it wasn't maintaining a style or preserving anything. It was more to do with creating something.
Yeah. So less a documentarian approach.
Right.
More the auteurist approach there.
Right.
Yeah. With So is it fair? I mean, all these things are overstated, I guess, but is it fair to say then that one of the hallmarks of your style is to take some pop production techniques and apply them to other areas, whether it's, you know, ambient or funk or jazz?
Yeah, I mean, for lack of a better word, and words in this business are here to speed up the explanation or the description, and I guess that's true.
Okay. I mean, you've done some, let's take a recording where there's a real shift in the kind of sound that we get with Ronald Shannon Jackson between, I'm trying to remember what went before it, maybe Man Dance or something, and then Red Warrior.
Right.
How involved were you in that project? When did you get involved, and how much did you shape that project?
Well, I would say in things, records, I don't recall exactly Man Dance, but they seem, Shannon is a very powerful drummer and always, I thought, expressed a lot of force and a lot of power and confidence in what he played, and that should always translate to me as something powerful in the way that rock records are recorded and sound. He has that same sort of power, and I don't think that translated in a lot of the early things, because people were dealing with a much smaller dimension in terms of the size of the sound, the depth of the low end. Just the overall picture was much more linear, much smaller, and I thought of Shannon's efforts as being much more powerful, and I think on a record like that, I certainly always encourage the idea of volume, and I encourage the idea of electric guitars, and definitely encourage the idea of a very heavier, much heavier drum approach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's direction, I'm sure, shaped a lot the end results of that record. And then working with engineers who have had experience doing metal and much more sort of extreme music, and not sort of the safe approach of people that are trying to reduce jazz records to a kind of almost a whisper. It's like, it's not the same thing. So I thought that his thing should be more in that style, more heavier.
Yeah. Now, did you say to him, I mean, you know, Ronald, we're going to hook you up with a drummer, an engineer that can mic these drums differently than they've been mic'd before?
Yeah, I think that we were conscious of that. We talked about that a lot, and that's coming from someone like him. He would want that as well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, none of these guys prefer to sound as bad as they do. Everybody would like to sound a little more focused and a lot bigger and a lot more powerful. There's no secret. Unless they're on some kind of a program where you're not supposed to do that according to your next paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you recorded Red Warrior, did he sit down and listen to playbacks with you, or was there a lot of things you did after recording?
No, I know him, you know, at the time we had worked together for years, and it was very much, you know, people come in to work and do the work, and he's there the whole time. It wasn't a manipulation of the artist in any sense that, you know, here's a jazz drummer, let's make him sound like a rock drummer and let's change it.
Mm-hmm.
Very much coming from him and very much of his interest, in his best interest, and he was there for the duration.
Yeah.
It's not always like that, and a lot of people don't care.
Yeah.
And a lot of people sabotage their own work, and a lot of people sabotage others, and it all goes into this whole kind of circus, but the end result, hopefully someone's happy with.
Uh-huh. Now, how did you hook up with Blood Ulmer for Are You Glad to Be in America?
Well, again, it's someone I had known from way back, and I had played with Shannon and played with him on different occasions, and we were always around in the same environment, playing live and playing festivals in Europe and playing clubs, and we sort of came out of the same scene here where people from a more jazz or avant-garde background begin to play in punk clubs and attract a slightly more of a different audience.
Yeah.
And we kind of all came out of that scene. Shannon Jackson, Blood Ulmer, even to some extent Henry Threadgill, Olu Dara, musicians like that, Ornette Coleman's Prime Time. All those groups were active at that point, which would have been sort of early 80s, late 70s, early 80s.
That no wave scene.
That kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but I mean, how did you get in, how'd you get in the door at Blue Note?
Well, I think at the time I had some support from Bruce Lundvall, who I had known because I had worked with him at Elektra.
Right.
And Blood wanted to do this, and the person that was managing him wanted to go that way, and so it was kind of a natural thing to do.
Uh-huh.
And I've since then done another project with him, and with other, with Ziggy Modalese from the Meters, and Bernie Worrell and Amina Meyer.
And that's, but that hasn't come out, has
that's
it?
That's not out yet. It's coming out September in Japan, and they're still working it out for America.
Okay, yeah. So did you, would you sit, was there a lot of pre-production on that job?
With usually with Blood, there's a lot of playing and then going over things with instruments. There's not a whole lot of conceptualizing verbally about what's going to happen, but there's definitely a lot of playing. And he likes, I think he likes to be comfortable with the playing side of it. And then you record.
Yeah.
And he's, and he kind of leaves the overdubs and things like that on that, those things. He kind of let me do whatever I wanted, but it, basically he had to be sure about the basic structure.
Yeah. Now, I understand, I mean, he records like a rock player to a great extent. I mean, he starts with a click track, does he?
Well, not on the things that we did, but I'm sure he does that on some of his other projects.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's someone that also is looking for other sounds and looking to sound always different and wouldn't mind if it changed drastically. He's not necessarily preserving any tradition. He's more, his style is more of a destructive, in a destructive way, I think, to tradition. It's something that's coming in from another angle.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this one album, which is, which I really like, comes out on Blue Note, and then boom, it's gone.
Yeah, that's right.
What was the story on that? I mean, how did...
I have no idea. I mean, it's, to me, it's an old story. It's, if you do anything interesting, it's going to go like that, and you, if you can ever manage to do something horrible, you can look forward to a big success.
Being haunted by it.
Exactly. Which I've seen both of it, both of those cases endlessly, and I don't understand it any more than the next person. But.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When you hooked up with Herbie Hancock and had, I guess, is the biggest hit of your career now, right?
Yeah.
Does that remain that?
That, yeah, probably so.
Did, was he really looking for a change in sound?
Well, I think he was looking, the people around him were looking to change him. And I think he was probably open for anything that happened. And certainly success wouldn't have been a bad way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, you know, it certainly wasn't really working directly with him in that case, in the way that with Blood you play and then you record, and in the way of Shannon there's dialogue. With Herbie it was really sort of a hatchet job, and it was more like bring a concept, bring an idea, do everything, and then he'll drop a few notes on it, and then it's his record, and then he's a star, and it's a big success.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't even sort of there for most of them.
So you mean by hatchet job, it was just a whole lot of cutting and pasting?
Well, yeah, and it was done incredibly quick and spontaneous, and with a crew of people that had a kind of alliance together, and it was done in, really all done in New York, and then taken out to L.A. practically finished before anyone even heard it. And I think, if I even remember, the day of his parts were done in a couple of hours, and the actual mixing of the one piece that became this big hit was done in less than 2 hours.
Okay.
And it was really just done without any... thinking. It was all just spontaneous.
Uh-huh.
Just ideas went on tape, done very quickly, and mixed very quickly, and that was that.
Yeah. Now, were you assembling different parts, or was there a large portion of it already? I mean, was it, it's often said of a film, right, that film is a collage art, but in fact it's assembled in the Hollywood style so frequently so that it doesn't look like a collage.
Right.
By the same token, was Rocket and Future Shock, was it a work of collage, and you pulled it, all these parts together? And
I just think it was a sort of a single idea. It was a tempo and a bass line and a way of appropriating that. It's like decorating a metronome for to suit the time, and that's all it was. And it was done really without a lot of research, a lot of work. I mean, bass line, one take, turntable thing, just, you'd be amazed just so quickly, just done, quick, cards, you know, car service driver waiting on the couch, Daniel Ponce, one take, take the tape out and put it up in L.A., and everybody says, what is this shit? I said, no, it'll work, you know, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Play a couple of notes on it and mix it, and that's that. So that's a freak record. It had everything to do with timing. It had probably a great deal to do with maybe some debt at Columbia, somebody trying to get some money back.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot to do with the idea of using a DJ in that context.
Yeah.
It's all timing.
Right.
Certainly wasn't any brilliant production or great piece of music. It was a freak incident with everybody benefits from the time.
Yeah. Now, you've done two recordings with Threadgill.
Yeah, there's two records out, and there's a new one that was just recorded. So
okay,
three.
So three. Now, had you listened to what he did at RCA, mainly with Ed Michelle, and said, now, I'm going to do something different?
Yeah, I wouldn't even have to listen to those to know that something different would be needed. I mean, I don't have too many positive things to say about most of the ways people are doing certain kinds of music,
uh-huh.
the kind of music we're talking about. I think it suffered a lot because of people's lack of adventure and just trying different things and trying to create different things. And sonically, everything is so squashed and so small and so timid, I can't really listen to that kind of music practically at this point. But I hadn't really researched those records. I could probably imagine what they sound like. And that's not good for someone like him because there's a lot of dynamics in what he's doing. And there's a lot of possibilities of size of sound. Like a tuba should really sound like a tuba. If you're listening to it close, you should feel the low end because there's no bass in that music. The tuba is the bass.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everything can fit together. The way he writes things, in terms of frequency, just the registers of instruments, he might put a high instrument playing in the lower register and a low one playing in the high. And the way it's written, it's one of the best examples, I think, of using frequency ranges in a positive way in terms of composition, because you really get to hear every instrument,
mm-hmm.
the voice of every instrument. And that has a lot to do with how you balance things, and that means writing things on tape manually, and then everything to do with the way the sounds are EQ'd, because you don't want one to cancel out the other. And that's all a feel. You have to really hear it as music. It's not about following the chart or being familiar with the tune. It has everything to do with being able to hear sounds fit together and know when it doesn't.
Yeah. Now, when you record that, is there separation here and you're using lots of tracks, or is it recorded in a more old-fashioned way with a lot of musicians and a lot of bleeding?
It's both, because it is recorded live, but it's recorded live in a way that you also have the option in a lot of cases for separation.
Uh-huh.
But it is done in an old-fashioned way in terms of everyone in the room playing instruments.
But how do you then have the option for separation?
By how you set up the room, by where you put the drums, and by who's next to who, and how things are mic'd, and then checking things as you go. And then also, it's down to the performance. You don't want to waste. But those kind of things, people rehearse the music and they play it. And from my perspective, everyone always sort of plays it best the first or second time. And so you got to be really ready to capture that performance. So it's really down to the relationship between an engineer and an assistant and a producer to make sure that you're ready to capture that sonically, that everything's perfectly in place. Because if you miss the first or second take, you might not ever get that back.
Yeah.
They're there to play that piece and move on.
So do you rehearse with them?
Well, you go to rehearsals maybe to get familiar, but I think it's more down to the setup and the being able to do it quickly and being spontaneous and being able to judge performances and to encourage people that something was great and maybe something was a little, you're a little suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in most cases with Threadgill, I always pretty much agree with what he says about that. We usually agree about performances, and their performances can be drastically different in that kind of music. It could even almost sound like another piece of music, depending on how a tempo gets started or how someone phrases or one solo is better than the other. I've been listening to so many people solo, I can just intuitively, I have a feeling for what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you listen together with him to playbacks.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess that's as you go. I mean, it's not at the end of the session. Something's recorded, you listen, you make suggestions.
Yeah, definitely. And then as far as mixing it, it's quite a lot of level manipulation and balance manipulation and EQ of things. And to me, that's all very much a part of composition. And in the past, composition was notation, and to me, it's memory. It's, to me, tape is composition.
Uh-huh.
That replaces notation because it's all memory.
Yeah.
Once it's on tape, it's no different than having it on paper.
So, for someone that doesn't understand a lot of these, and for readers that even understand perhaps less, how do elaborate on that just a little bit for me? That, I mean, this is a really interesting notion that you've introduced here. The definition of composition has really been expanded.
Well, it's expanding every day and all the time, and it's being redefined. I mean, Cage said, 30 years ago that in the future records will be made by records, and then in the last 10 or 15 years, DJs have proved that in genres like hip-hop, which are made from older records. Their new record is made from an old record. It's proof of that. And as far as writing something down on paper and calling it a composition that can be played and repeated, to me, it's not that different than recording something, memorizing it, and repeating it. Whether you memorize it by then notating it is one way, or whether you do it with a computer, or whether you do it with a sampler, or whether you use the actual piece and reproduce it the way DJs reproduce records to create records. It's all a new way, and there's always a new way to create music. And it is always down to collage, because you are always fitting things together.
Yeah.
And the more sort of desperate and far-fetched concepts I think that do fit together as collage, if you can make them feel like music, then that's an achievement. And if you're just always repeating the style, repeating the form, repeating the phrase, copying the master, or whoever, because all these things didn't come as styles and they didn't come as forms. It all started with the person that had an idea. It was copied and copied and copied until you developed this style. And then it's preserved by people who know very well they can't do better.
One of the things you're saying, too, is that the ability, whereas people, I guess, are slowly beginning, all too slowly, to accept that cutting and pasting is a kind of artistry and a kind of instrument of music, making music.
No, it's totally, that's what it is, totally.
You're also saying, though, that the ability to know how to EQ something is equally...
Well, that's a matter of, I think that's a question of taste, and people will always disagree, and a lot of times they don't always know how to look at the whole picture, because you can't argue about a sound of an instrument with someone who's looking at the whole picture if you're only thinking about the sound of the instrument. And it's usually the person that played the sound that have the advanced opinion about the tonality, about the EQ, and about how it fits. But a person that's trying to fit that into a bigger picture where you have 20 other frequencies, 20 other sounds and tones, that person should be calling the shots, because they know how to fit sound together so that it doesn't hurt the ear, or that you can hear all the parts being played.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a pretty controversial producer. Do you often feel that you're in the midst of a battle of aesthetics?
Not always, but I see that a lot of times, of course.
I mean, because I've thought about, what was it in the 40s there when Upanassier came over and you had the battle between the Moldy Figs and the Beboppers.
Right.
Then what we get in our day is this kind of battle between people essentially objecting to different timbres and saying,
right,
I don't like this sound.
Right.
They're not arguing nearly as much about, I don't like this particular melodic line or the
right
way what's being done to a chord. But
right,
they argue about sonics.
Right.
Now, and so the controversy that, every time I've ever read anyone, that has quarrels with the way you produce a record, what they're fundamentally arguing with is your taste in sonics.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Talk to me, because he's recently departed, working with Sonny Chirac on that wonderful recording, Ask the Ages.
Right.
Did you hook him up with Pharoah Sanders?
Well, I suggested it. I mean, we were on tour in Germany, and I know he you know, obviously he had played and worked with Pharaoh in the past, and I thought that was always a strong point for him and a strong point of reference, and it was one of the people that he, I know, admired. So we suggested the idea of trying to do a project where he could do that again and incorporate, even go even further in that direction and bring in Elvin Jones. And then Charnett Moffett was a logical choice. He was recommended by practically everyone that I asked about when I told him who the rest of the group would be.
Mm-hmm. And you were really used to Sharrock's style because you had played with him for years in Last Exit.
Oh yeah, no, I knew. I had done a lot of recordings with him and, I don't know, a lot of live performances.
Yeah. Now, are there special tricks in, as a producer in getting Sonny Sharrock's sound?
Well, he over time developed his own by using certain amplifiers, by deciding on a particular guitar. He was open to processing the guitar. He was open to different effects. And you just kind of work with that until everyone's happy, including him, and in a way, especially him. And he's quite easy to please, and you could always take it a lot further, and he wouldn't object to that.
Mm-hmm. Because as he said, he wanted to sound like a saxophone player. Did that affect the types of treatments? I mean,
no, I think that was more related, I think, to the comment that he made in the 70s or the late 60s. And I think at that time he was really more than trying to sound like a saxophone. I'm sure he was trying to get out of sounding like a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked the sax. He wanted to play saxophone.
Yeah.
And for some health reason, he switched to the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was always trying to get the sound away from the guitar, and I never heard him play the guitar where he sounded like another guitarist. I mean, sometimes it would sound melodically, it would remind you of a certain horn player, not necessarily the tone, but maybe the phrasing or the attack or the approach. But I never thought for a second that thing he just played sounded like someone who plays the electric guitar.
Right.
Which means he had a gift and he had an original voice, and he found it by avoiding the cliches that were given to the instrument by people that were repetitious.
Yeah. And developed that remarkably early.
Yeah, very early.
Right.
All he did with it, I think it's a person who got better and better melodically and stronger as a soloist, and the sound was getting bigger all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, the recordings you do now, with the exception of the especially the ambient ones that where you're making records from records and doing this kind of thing, are a little less eclectic than One Down or Memory Serves.
Right.
What's led you to that position to divide your music into maybe more categories?
I don't know. I think just the idea of working with sound, you keep delving further and further into it, and at a point, lines or themes disappear, rhythm disappears, it all gets sort of washed away by just sound, and you start to deal with areas of sound that can be manipulated and processed and changed, and it's endless, and sometimes it takes over, and sometimes you appropriate it with other sort of sounds, which could be rhythmic, which could be melodic, which could be conventional instrumentation. But when you start to work in that area, you step into a space that's endless.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying as you've developed, you've become more interested in just pure sonics.
Yeah, more and more.
Yeah.
But not to take anything away from the playing of instruments, but it's down to who's playing it and what they're playing.
Right.
And with the sound, it's always a mystery, and it's always, to me, an endless possibility of what you can find or what will sort of emerge from a combination of textures. You might find something completely original.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I, like a lot of people who grew up and never remember a time, you know, when there was an Elvis, I fell in love not only with so much Elvis, but the sound of Sam Phillips, that radiator shop.
Right.
I mean, the actual sound of that room.
Right.
Do you go through phases where you say, this is the sound that I'm most interested in now, this is the room I like the best, this is the filter I like the best?
Yeah, I think you do with certain things, but it's not, I mean, I'm sort of lucky that I can move in and out of situations that are all pretty different, so I don't get, at the moment, too used to any one particular sonic environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always kind of discovering things.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that it would have... Do you sit around and think in an old way, let's say, like an A&R man would have... What would it have been like to have paired Nile Rodgers and Sonny Chirac in a duet?
Well, I mean, that particular... I couldn't imagine, but... I mean, there's endless combinations, and you don't really... Sometimes you won't really know what it would be until you hear it.
Uh-huh.
Because at any given time, something surprising could happen.
Yeah. Let me ask you about when you, back to that Blood Alma recording, when you recorded under the auspices of Blue Note there,
yes.
Were you able to use whatever studio, I can't remember what studio that was done in, whatever studio you wanted and basically submit?
Yeah, it was no different than doing anything else. I always sort of have to start out with control or I don't do it.
Uh-huh.
So it's always got to be wherever we want to record and in whatever sort of conditions and arrangements are set, just like the music should be from this side. And I never really worked otherwise. Or if it looked like it was going to be that, I decided against it.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a much more active kind of producer, do you find that you still are involved in those kind of roles that producers have been, of almost in some cases being a cheerleader, and other times kicking somebody's ass, or you know whatever, just a variety of roles?
There is, but I think once you've done it a lot, you. Could be more of a subtle science. I think the best way is to set up a right environment, and then if you set up the right feeling among people, then music can happen. And I think if it's anything outside of that, there always could be trouble. If it's not the right environment, if you know there's problems between certain people, if technically there's always problems, there's a lot of things that could lead to something not happening.
Mm-hmm. This is an unfair question, but I'll ask, because I understand comparable questions, but is there one production that may surprise me that you say, this is where I felt like I hit my stride, this is the one where I felt really proud of what I do?
No, because they're all so, in a way, they're all different constructions, and you feel different things about different ones because of your perspective, and hopefully that perspective is changing all the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There's no particular one, probably I could find 20, maybe, or more, but there's no one record.
Yeah. One of the things that Cage said, I mean, you mentioned him, and I really love his, I love his talk. I love to read him as much
right.
as anything else. He talked about learning harmony, and he said, I need to learn harmony. And at one point, he says, I must study Duchamp.
Right.
And I thought, man, that is so...
That makes more sense to me than, than what you would normally imagine.
Yeah, and so the concept there is, are there people completely outside of the realm of music that you would look to and say, this person has affected the way I make music?
Yeah, there's many more outside than inside.
Can you give me a couple of examples and how they impacted the way you record?
I'm not sure you could say how you break it down to how it affected the way you record, but you certainly get maybe another point of view or a different type of reference. It has a lot to do with structure. I mean, artists like Joseph Beuys and writers like William Burroughs or Paul Bowles or Brian Gyson, writing, I think, has been really useful.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, with artists that I've worked with who are mostly collage artists like Shinro Otaki or Tadanori Yoko or James Cohenlein are big influences on the way they put collage systems together. Dave McKean, who's an English artist, Russell Mills, and these are all people that I actually get a chance to interact with, so it helps a lot, and it's been a big influence over putting, it definitely is an influence over putting music together. I don't think you always know how to say, I looked at this image and I did this sound. I don't think we ever could break it down to that. The language is going to limit us in the description. I don't think we don't yet know how to talk like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, even though you can't do one-to-one analog, you're saying maybe that it affects one's way of working or even a mood.
It definitely creates and affects the mood. It alters and, I think, pushes up a propriety system. It gives angles, I think, on different decision of why something works and something doesn't. It has everything to do with establishing taste and point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's from writing, from painting, and hopefully even from film, if somebody would make some, you know, it could be done.
Yeah. So I see a kind of an impish quality maybe in some of the stuff that you've done, and I see that same kind of an attitude in Joseph Boyce.
Right.
I mean, so I think in some ways we perhaps just, we connect with people we feel are kindred spirits.
Yeah.
And
in the same way that Joseph Boyce's point of view or his art would affect sound, he himself was affected by nature and by ecology and the economy, and Rudolf Steiner was a big influence on Joseph Boyce's art, and Joseph Boyce's art could be a big influence on someone's jazz record, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all, it all relates if it's natural.
Yeah. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay.
And appreciate your time very much. Let me get an address from you. This thing probably won't come out forever, but when it does, I'll send you a copy.
Okay. You could, if you have Bill Murphy's contact, you could send it to Island.
Do you have his address handy? Because I call the old number, you know, and it.
Do you have the new number?
Yeah, I have the new phone number.
It'd
so
probably be best to check with him for
with
the
Bill.
Mailing, or you could send it to my own office.
Okay.
Which is Material Inc., and it's 611 Broadway, Suite 541, New York, New York, and 112 is the code.
Okay. And I can give you my number if you want, in case
okay.
you wake up at midnight and say, gee, I should have said this, or
okay.
got to tell him this. It's Mike Jarrett. Jarrett,
okay.
And I'm at 717-741-3427.
3427, okay.
Thanks, Bill, very
All right.
much.
Take
See
care.
Ya. Bye.